The date is March 4th, 2010, and we are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as a part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Leo R. McCormick, born March 1st, 1930, in New Smyrna, Florida. My name is James McCannell, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reitinger, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Leo, what was your period of service?
From October the 2nd, 1955, until October the 1st, 1957.
Okay.
And then I was on a reserve status for a number of years after that.
I see. Thank you. During which conflicts did you serve?
None. No conflicts.
So during that time you
were... It was during the, it was in between the Korean War and the Vietnam War.
Okay, thank you. And what was your rank?
PFC in the end.
Okay. And where did you serve?
I took basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, first 8 weeks, and then the second 8 weeks, infantry training. Then I was trained, transferred to Fort Riley, Kansas, in the early part of 1956.
Okay, thank you. And you had told me earlier that you were also in the Merchant Marine before joining the Army. Can you tell us a little bit about the Merchant Marine?
Right. I went to sea when I was 17 years old. didn't have a lot of opportunities when I was young. But I managed to get into Merchant Marine when I was 17 years old and went to sea. On the various ships. A lot of them were military transportation ships that we carried military supplies and fuels for the various Army and Navy posts all over the world. And I went to sea until I got drafted in 1955 and spent 2 years in the Army. And then the Army time counted on my Merchant Marine retirement, actually. They counted those 2 years in as retirement. Then after I got out of the Merchant, I had to go into the reserves in Jacksonville for a period of time. But I told them I had to go back to sea because that was my basic job. So I did attend Camp Blanding several times for, I think it was like a weekend training or something like that.
Sure.
And I remember going on the firing line there with the carbines And then I had to go back to sea, of course, and I continued to go to sea until 1974. Oh. And then I retired from the Merchant Marine. I had to have 20 years of sea time, and the 2 years Army counted as well, to retire from the Merchant Marine. It's a Union retirement pension.
Okay.
And you had to serve at least 8 to 18 years on ships and 2 years in the military. So I get a Merchant Marine retirement.
All right. And you say you were drafted while you were in the Merchant Marine at age 25, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And what happened? I mean, what did you have to do then after you got your draft notice?
Well, I was pretty disappointed because I was making $500 a month, which was a good salary at that time.
Sure.
I got drafted into the Army and my pay went to $80 a month. So it was pretty catastrophic for me,
yeah.
But after I got into it, I enjoyed it more. But the thing about it that I remember most was the fact that I got in such good physical condition, you know, standing, and I worked in the engine room on these ships and didn't get that much exercise except for running up and down the ladders.
Mm-hmm.
But after I got into it, at first I thought, oh, no, I'm not going to make it. But then, as I physically improved, then it had more and more enjoyment to it, I guess.
Well, when you had to report to Fort Jackson then, right?
Fort Jackson. Well, we reported here to the draft place there on I think it was Walnut Street or something like there in Jacksonville,
uh-huh.
And they swore you in. You make you took the one step forward, and then they transported you, I think, by bus to Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
So they transported you as part of a group?
As a group.
Yeah.
As a group. We went to Fort Jackson. Sort of a Forrest Gump looking thing.
Well, what do you remember mostly about the day that you reported into Fort Jackson? Is there something that sticks out in your mind? You know, like I know that you probably got your hair shorn.
Oh yes, I got that haircut. Oh no, all the hair. Of course, I didn't have a head short hair already anyway, but that haircut was catastrophic,
mm-hmm.
and it was quite an experience. I guess, and then the sergeant's hollering at you constantly. But, you know, you get used to it. I guess I've always been sort of militaristic anyway during my life.
Yeah. How was the food and basic training?
It was quite good. But I never seemed to get enough to eat because you burn so much energy, you know. From, you know, I did wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning with those whistles.
Yeah.
And then you're out on Tank Hill there in Fort Jackson. And then the physical training and then the marching and just constantly on the go.
I imagine they probably ran you through the mess hall pretty quickly, too. Didn't
exactly.
They?
And if you got the opportunity, you would run around and get back in line and eat the second time. I remember that vividly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were last in line, you didn't quite get that opportunity sometimes.
Now, what were the barracks conditions like?
Well, they were the old World War II barracks at that time. They're two-story.
Mm-hmm.
And I would wind up upstairs, just like I did in Fort Riley, Kansas. I was upstairs in the old Army barracks. Excuse me.
And when you're in basic training and had to go to the rifle range, was the rifle range fairly close by, or?
No, you usually had to march quite a ways. As I remember, we had to march a long way to get to the rifle ranges. They were pretty well isolated.
You remember what weapon that you certified on?
The M1, the old M1 of
M1
Grand of the World War II and the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
M1 Grand. I was quite good, actually. I fired expert. I had that expert marksman medal, which I don't know what happened to it now.
Mm-hmm. So then once you got out of basic training, you also had your advanced infantry training at Fort Jackson?
Advanced infantry training at Fort Jackson.
Mm-hmm. What was that was different from basic?
You know, I really can't remember that much about it. I really can't remember that too much about it, except they, you know, instructed you on how to stay warm, you know, that they put layers of clothing on you in the wintertime to trap your body heat to stay warm. And
sure.
And then they trained you in the mortars. We had the mortars where we dropped the shell in the mortar round. And then everybody, we all run out, and the sergeant told us to all go out and round up one round that it embedded. And we got out there, and there was nothing there because all the rounds had went into the ground. We couldn't find anything. We finally wised up and see this little indentation in the ground. We reached down and kind of pull it out and bring. Everybody had to bring back one round.
Oh, okay. So they could reuse it?
So they could reuse it.
Uh-huh. I see. Were there a lot of bivouacs out in the field during the AIT?
No. We pretty much stayed in the barracks the entire time because the winters, it was, you know, it was cold. It was during the winter time that when I was training.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, as you told me, after AIT, you got assigned to Fort Riley, Kansas.
Fort Riley, Kansas.
Did they give you any leave time between?
They did. I think it was right at Christmas time of 1955 that I came home, and I was living in Jacksonville. That was my address anyway. It was my uncle in East Jacksonville, and we had about 2 weeks of leave time during the Christmas.
So you weren't married at the time?
Oh, no, no.
Well, then you reported into Fort Riley, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And what was different about Fort Riley versus Fort Jackson that you remember?
Well, they both of them, especially Fort Riley, seemed very isolated. You were right. We just way out in the in the country. It was sort of a hilly country, it was rather isolated. I think the only thing, when you walked out of the gate, you were in Ogden, Kansas, and I think the first thing there was a bar. And we would frequent the bar, of course, and And there was, other than that, you had to travel a good distance to get to, say, Potika or Topeka or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have a, did you carry a Class A pass all the time, or did you have to check
out? I think we had a Class A pass all the time.
Yeah.
The thing about Fort Riley, I remember, was that we were off the entire weekend. We didn't have any Saturday morning duty like a lot of forts did. Mm-hmm. We were off the entire weekend from Friday evening all the way until Monday morning.
What were your duties at Fort Riley?
Well, I was in the infantry at first.
Mm-hmm.
Then somehow I got put into the Signal Corps for a period of time. So I learned how to operate these radios in these trucks, these mobile truck communication centers. And then later on they put me in a transportation outfit, which was pretty nice, you know, to be able to drive the officers around in jeeps,
mm-hmm.
and drive the 2.5-ton trucks and 3/4-ton trucks as well.
When you were in Fort Riley, did you participate in any war games or anything like that?
Yeah, we did. We went out, I think it must have been the winter of 56 probably. I thought I was going to freeze to death. The temperature got down to zero, and everybody warned about getting your feet wet, you know, and out in that frozen territory there at Fort Riley. Excuse me. And then I remember that I actually did get a little bit wet, and I was trying to get into that sleeping bag and and stay warm, but it was not easy. It was, I thought I was going to freeze. It was zero or below, and the snow was on the ground, but we managed to survive it. I think we were out there at least a week. And I was glad to get back into the barracks, you know. When you come back in the barracks, you feel like, like, you know, it's kind of mysterious and weird to have a roof over your head again. You had that funny feeling that when you went into the barracks.
Well, when you were out in the field like that in the snow, what did you have? How'd they feed you? Did you have hot showers?
They had hot showers. Yeah, you had your mess kit with you, and you would go down to the mess hall wherever they had it. And they would put the food in your mess tray, and you'd eat out in the field like that. Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a time that they fed you rations instead? You know, like sea.
Yeah, they did. Occasionally, you have those sea rations. I remember that.
Yeah.
And they were quite good too. They were nourishing. As I think sometimes you'd have a can of fruit of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was there anyone of significance that you remember at Fort Riley that made a big impression?
It was. There was a Sergeant Reynolds there. He was the first sergeant of the first platoon that I was in. And I don't know, it was just something about him. He was like a father figure, you know, and I really looked up to him.
So you learned a lot from
him. I learned a lot from him. He he was probably a World War II veteran, but there was something about him that just give you all the respect in the world for him.
What was the unit that you were in at Fort Riley? Was that the 1st Infantry Division?
At 1st Infantry Division, I was in the 1st Platoon of the 16th Infantry Regiment,
uh-huh.
of the 1st Division. And, yeah.
So you were in the Big Red One.
The Big Red One, yes.
Yeah.
Very proud of it.
Yes. Well, that's great. Is there anything else about Fort Riley that you think would be, you know, our people would be interested to hear about? Significance?
Well, I do remember that every Friday we did a 9-mile march.
Oh, really?
Every Friday afternoon we did a 9-mile march. And I can't remember, you know, the exact routes, but we went around and then around one road and we came back another road. And we had one heavyset Hispanic sergeant that had a problem trying to make it, you know, but he'd kind of dropped back, but he kept up. We kept looking back to see if he was all right,
yeah.
And I remember that vividly. Every Friday we did that 9-mile march.
How did they give you any kind of rest periods during this 9-mile march?
You know, I can't remember vividly. They might have,
yeah.
But I don't think we did. I think it was a continuous 9-mile march.
And that was probably in full combat.
Exactly. You had all your equipment on, your pack,
yeah.
And canteen, and and your rifle as well, and your heart helmet.
Interesting. So did you ever get to, while you were at Fort Riley, did you ever get to go on leave and come back to Jacksonville?
I did, yes. My grandfather became extremely ill in the winter of 1957, and I came home to Jacksonville by train, I think it was, and came to Jacksonville and stayed with him a period of time. Had to be like about August or September of 1955, and I visited with my grandfather, and I was home for 2 weeks, and then I went back to Fort Riley, and I think he died between that time and the time I got discharged.
So then you're back at Fort Riley again after that. I want to ask you, what were race relations like at Fort Riley? Were there a lot of minorities or a few minorities, or blacks and
I would say that in our platoon specifically, I remember one Mexican boy that was on the same floor in the first platoon with me, and I speak some Spanish, so I was able to communicate with him a little bit, but he was a machine gunner, as I can remember. And I would say that in our platoon, there was probably about 10 blacks, ten black people. We got along quite well, though. But I remember when I was in the basic training, they paired us off one time, one-on-one, and we had to turn right and I faced a black fella. Well, I didn't think anything about it because I was in the Merchant Marine earlier, and I was well integrated when I was quite young, and it didn't bother me a bit to be in the same tent with this black fella. But these other white boys came up to me and said, what are you doing staying in that tent with that black fella? But I didn't pay any attention to him. I went ahead and stayed in the tent with him. We shared, we both of us had a tent half.
Yeah.
And we put it together. I didn't think any of it, but I remember those two or three white boys coming up to me and saying, asking me, what are you doing? Staying? And I, as if I had a choice, because we faced up in some way, and I just got matched with him.
Do you remember where they were from, where their home was, these
who?
Three guys that...
No, I can't remember that, no.
I mean, they weren't from the north or south.
I can't remember. I can't remember that.
Well, it sounds like you had some pretty good experiences then, in your duty stations. Did they have things for you when you were Fort Riley? Did they have things for you to do on post during your leisure time, like movies and things like that?
Not that much. Well, they did have movies, as I remember. But I can't remember too much about but they didn't have a lot of things to do there, to be quite honest with you. You could go to church. And
was there an EM club? Officers Club or an NCO Club?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Yeah, they had refreshments there, if beer or whatever you wanted to have, treats and things like that. I remember that.
Do you recall whether there were many women, I know not in the military, but, working at Fort Riley that, maybe you'd go to dances or something like that? Was
no.
Like that?
I don't know. No, it was fairly isolated. There was not very much excitement around in that area, to be honest with you.
Well, what was it like? Excuse me. What was it like when you the day that you mustered out of the Army? What was that like?
Well, I was elated. I was elated to get out because, like I say, I was only making $80 a month.
Sure.
As a PFC. Of course, I might have gotten a raise. I can't remember. It wasn't much. But I was elated to get out, and then I had to go back to Jacksonville and then report to this reserve organization, the armory there in Jacksonville. I told them that I had to go back to sea, that I didn't have any choice. That was my occupation. So I went back to the Union Hall and registered to ship out again. But I remember going to Camp Blanding several times, you know, to train on the firing line and all, over the weekends.
Sure. Did at Camp Blanding then, did they have helicopters then?
I don't remember any of them at Camp Blanding, but we had a number of them there at Fort Riley. I remember the first time I went up in a helicopter, and I was scared. That thing went straight up. And when I, they had a strap across the door, of course, but I looked out of the door, and I saw those barracks down there. They looked like little tiny match heads, practically, you know, and I, oh, not good as alive. And later on, had an opportunity. He would hover up 8, 10, or 9, or 10 feet, and you had to jump out and hit the ground, you know. I think my helmet went one way and my rifle went the other way or something like that. And then the helmet come down and hit my head. Go whap.
So that was quite a new experience.
That was an experience.
So then you're mustered out of the Army. You've gone back to Jacksonville. You've signed up with the reserves. You've also registered again with the Merchant Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long did it take from that point before you shipped out again?
You had 90 days to ship out for your time, your previous sea time and your military time, to count on your retirement. I shipped out at probably about 80 days later. I get on a tanker, an MSTS, Military Sea Transportation tanker, and we would, the Yukon, it's a big T5 tanker, and we would go to Venezuela a lot, and to Baton Rouge and the various seaports in the Gulf of Mexico, and pick up usually jet fuel or aviation gas and deliver it to bases in Key West and in Jacksonville. I went to Thule, Greenland twice. That's above the Arctic Circle.
Oh, yeah.
Thule, Greenland, we went there several times, and we'd carry full loads of diesel fuel for them so they could last over the winter. But you get to go, you only get into Thule about 3 months, because it was ice locked after that. And I remember waking up one morning hearing this noise, boo, 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 boo. I looked out the porthole, and here was a tug pushing this iceberg away from the side of the ship. But I went back to sea, and then for a number of years until 1975, and then I retired from the Merchant Marine.
During this time, did you get married or afterwards?
Oh, I got married right after I got out of the Army.
Oh, did you? Well, where did you meet your wife?
She was living with my aunt. My aunt was an elderly lady, lived in Springfield, in Jacksonville, and she was living with my aunt, my great aunt. She introduced me to Shirley, and then we dated several times, and then as soon as I got out of the Army, and we got married on October the 10th of 1957.
Okay, and so you lived, or you were based, I guess you would say, in Jacksonville during the whole time that you were a Merchant Marine.
That's correct.
Okay, and then when you retired then in 75, you came back to Jacksonville?
I came back to Jacksonville. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I own two homes in North Shore.
But you're now living in Nassau County?
Yes. We sold excuse me. I'm gonna have to use a cough drop. It might be interesting.
Leo, tell us about your time in Thule.
Thule, Greenland. Yeah. You want me to recount the iceberg incident?
Yeah.
One morning I woke up in my room and I heard this noise, boo, 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 boo. And I looked out the porthole, and here was a tugboat or towboat pushing this glacier away from the side of the ship, because Thule was frozen in most of the year except for about 3 months out of the year in the summertime. And I went there several times on this large military tanker, the Yukon. It was a T5 tanker, and they were pushing the iceberg from the side of the ship, and I was kind of fascinated about that. And we I think that's above the Arctic Circle, that Thule, and it belongs to, actually it belongs to Denmark. But there were a number of military, different militaries there. There were American military. In fact, the boy I knew quite well in Jacksonville years ago when he was young, he was stationed there. And one of my wife's brothers, I think, was stationed there as well. And they had a number of military, they had Canadian military there, Norwegian military, Danish military, of course, and American soldiers and American sailors. And it was a fascinating place because when you got there during the summertime, it was always twilight. The sun never came up, and of course it never set either. It was like, it was kind of almost dark, but not quite dark, but it was still not light as well. It was twilight all the time. And it was a mysterious experience, really, because you'd wake up at noon, be the same. You wake up at midnight, same thing.
So tell us about the USO.
Well, they had a USO that was very large, and the drinks were so cheap, I couldn't believe it. It was like a mixed drink for 10 cents. American, or a beer for a dime. And a lot of the fellows got quite intoxicated because of this. Mm-hmm. For several dollars, they could just drink just about all night long.
Well, that must have been quite an experience.
It was. It was interesting, and then I can remember something like that.
Yeah. So now you retired in 1975, came back to Jacksonville, and what is it that, what brought you to Nassau County?
We had a little home there in North Shore in Jacksonville, and just a 50 by 100 foot lot, and it was just about paid for. I had a 20 year mortgage. I bought it in 1954, and I'd already sold one that I'd bought in 1953, and we decided we wanted to have more room. We wanted to have horses, you know, and have more of an out life. So we came up here to Fernandina, and Mr. Sheffield was developing the area out of 107 South in Holly Point. So we bought four lots. We bought four half-acre lots, and we had a big, nice, double-wide trailer, and we bought a mare, and she had a colt, a little filly, and we got another little mare, and we could go horseback riding and really enjoy ourselves a lot more. And that's basically the reason we wanted to move up here.
And when was that?
1973. Mm-hmm. We moved up here in 1973. I went to sea for about two more years until 1975. Then I retired and came home, and my wife worked for the Sheriff's Department for 29 years.
Oh, really?
She worked for the Sheriff about 29 years. Actually, she worked right here in this jail at first. At first, when she first started with the Sheriff's Department, she worked here in the jail. She was a cook and also a jailer. She was a female jailer. And she worked for the Sheriff's Department for 29 straight years and retired twice.
That's a long time.
She gets two retirements.
Uh-huh. Do you still have the horses?
No. Back in 80, probably about 83, my son Richard came to the city commissioners, Mm-hmm. and applied to start a horse and carriage business. He first started the first horse and carriage business in Fernandina in about 1983, I think it was. He called it Old Town Carriage. And he had four horses on our place there that he kept, and one of them was a big Arab horse. Can't remember, it was a blonde-looking horse. And he had three others. And I had two smaller horses for riding myself. And I'm trying to remember that woman's name that bought the horse and carriage. She still owns it here.
Yeah, just around the corner here. Isn't
Old Town Carriage, yeah, she still owns it. Mm-hmm. Richard sold it to her. And Richard lives on a boat here in the harbor.
Oh.
He lives on the 80-foot boat, the OA Bloxham. And Richard and I did a rescue Monday. We went from here to Cumberland Island, and there was two fellows about our age. They were in their 70s. I couldn't believe it. And they were run high and dry. The sailboat was over like that.
They had gone aground.
They had went aground in about two. They had about 2 foot of water under them when we got there. So we had to wait for about 2.5 hours for the tide to start coming in. So we put a rope to them and we pulled and pulled for about 45 minutes before we got them off. But my son does that now. He does the rescue here in this Fernandina area.
Did he actually?
That's how I got my eyes kind of bloodshot, I think.
Oh, yeah. Did you guys actually answer a call, or were you just out there?
He's on call. He works for the company, and I can't think of the name of it right now.
Uh-huh.
But he works for a company. They have these rescue boats, like the one they have here in the harbor. Richard has the one here in the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
They have them in Brunswick and Jekyll and here, and several of them in Jacksonville as well, right on down the...
Is that Towboat U.S.?
That's it, yeah.
Towboat U.S.
Towboat U.S. Mm-hmm.
So, did these people that went aground, do you think they called Towboat U.S. right away, or did they call Coast Guard?
No, they called Towboat USA right away.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
They called Towboat USA, and Richard responds right away. He lives on this OA Bloxham right here in the harbor.
Uh-huh.
It's an 80-foot boat that he has. But he does the rescues. I went with him Monday because Monday was my birthday. I was 80 years old Monday. I think I got something in my eye that day. We finally managed to get those fellows off there, both in their 70s, and they were perched way up on the top of the side of that boat when we got there. And it was cold and miserable, too.
It was definitely heeled over, huh?
It was heeled over. I think it was just about high. In fact, you could see the ground right in front of him. What he did, he instead of following the markers, they curved to the left. And many people do the same thing. They just run aground on that sandbar up there right by Cumberland.
Uh-huh.
Can't remember the name of that mansion up there.
Well, those guys are lucky.
Grayfield.
Yeah.
Those guys are lucky to have a service like that that they could call.
Exactly. And then last night, I think he did the same thing again down at Matanzas Inlet. Not Matanzas Inlet.
What, Nassau Sound?
Nassau Sound.
Yeah.
He did one last night at Nassau Sound, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pulled somebody else off.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of shoals down there.
Yeah, I know it, yeah. You can run aground quite easily, yeah.
Well, Leo, what are you doing with your time now besides helping your son on these rescues?
Well, we have some rental properties that we have to maintain. That's basically what we have to try to maintain. There were 3 trailers and 3 apartments that I rent.
Takes up a lot of your
time. And it takes all the time, you know, in the world, you know. Sometimes I wonder if it's worth it or not, you know.
Do you do all the maintenance and everything yourself?
And most of it, except, one of my grandson-in-laws is a plumber. So he does all the plumbing work and everything like that. And I've got to the point now where I can't hardly walk behind this lawnmower. I'm going to have to buy a riding lawnmower, it looks like.
Yeah.
I just can't hardly do it anymore.
It's harder and harder.
But it does take a lot of maintenance when you do things like that.
Apartments and
yeah, apartments. The apartment. And I just got through renovating one of them, and this man and lady and man were glad to get it, you know, because it's. And I don't charge a high rent or anything like some of these places around here.
Well, is there anything else you think that we need to?
You know, I'd like to tell you about when I was 11 years old. I was living on Miami Beach with my mother. She was a waitress. She worked as a waitress. And it was December the 7th, 1941. And the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Well, everybody was, I felt very apprehensive and kind of scared, you know, because of that. I said, what in the world is our way of living going to come to an end or what? So... The following morning was Monday morning, and I went to school on Miami Beach. And I went to school, And for some reason, the teacher took all of us up on the top of the schoolhouse. And they had that door up there. We walked out on top of the schoolhouse. And we could look, you could look over the palm trees, and you could see this tanker. I believe it was a tanker that had been torpedoed by the Germans. The Germans used to set out off of Miami Beach underwater and wait until nightfall. Then they would come up, and they would see these ships coming silhouette between them and the lights of Miami Beach. And they would just one torpedo or a couple of artillery blasts and the ship. When we looked over, we could look over the, when that schoolhouse, I remember looking over and seeing that ship that had been torpedoed, and it was run aground, right? And what really disappointed me was the only recreation I had at that time was to be able to go to the beach every day and go swimming. And they had the beaches roped off, and these Coast Guard or Navy guy in a white uniform was walking up and down the beach with a rifle. Yeah. They were actually afraid that these Germans might come ashore, which they did eventually right here in Jacksonville Beach.
Yeah.
They put off four saboteurs, I think it was. And,
I remember, it seems like I read something about that Jacksonville was shelled also.
Was it?
By a submarine, yeah, by a German U-boat.
Well, this, yeah. And that's, I thought that was kind of significant to me to be able to remember looking at, and why that teacher did that, I'll never know why she took us up on top of that building.
Do you remember what she said about it?
No, I can't remember that. Evidently, she just wanted us to be able to see it, I guess. I don't know.
See that image. Yeah. Boy, that's interesting. Well, I think we can go ahead and wrap this up, Leo. I want to say that I appreciate you sharing your experiences with us. And also, I want to thank you for your service to our country.
Well, thanks very much, yeah.
And this concludes the interview with Leo R. McCormick.